The last time T.J. Styles was here, it was to discuss his highly acclaimed biography of Jesse James, an outlaw who robbed trains and held up banks. Today, Mr. Styles joins us to talk about Cornelius Vanderbilt, the man who owned some of those trains and built much of the American railroad network, and whose business practices helped create our modern capitalist system. The First Tycoon is published by Knopf, and I'm very pleased that it brings T.J. Styles back to our show. Hi.
I'm very happy to be back.
Did Jesse James rob any of Cornelius Vanderbilt's trains?
No. Jesse James operated mostly in the West, or what we now call the Midwest. And Vanderbilt, I found, was not involved in Western railroads.
It was mostly New York.
New York and between Chicago and New York, basically.
Is it just a coincidence that both of them have been described as robbers?
I don't think so. The guy who kind of operates outside the system is really interesting to me. He doesn't have to be a good guy, but that person who's sort of at odds with the prevailing society or ethics is kind of an interesting figure.
Although you've been careful to point out that, unlike Jesse James, Vanderbilt prided himself on being honest and a man of his word.
That's right.
Was he?
Yes, actually he was. But he would push his business partners and his rivals to the absolute limit. But, you know, when I started off, I assumed that he was involved in corruption and lying and cheating, like so many business figures were throughout the 19th century. And I found that, for example, when he had business disputes, he almost always suggested that they refer it to arbitration. And when his opponents agreed, he almost always won, which is a very telling fact, I think.
But he is one of those people who's generally respected rather than liked. It was said that when he died, he left no debts and no friends.
That's true. I think that at his best, he's kind of like that teacher or coach that so many people have had, who was tough and sometimes even mean, but you end up walking away respecting them. And I point out in the book that I in no way depict him as a nice man. He wasn't a nice man, but he earned his respect. He earned respect from other people, and he earned his pride in himself.
Could you become the wealthiest man in American history, which is the claim you make for him, more than Bill Gates, if you are a nice guy?
I don't think so. I'm not sure that he actually was the richest man in American history, but...
Well, he died with $100 million. I don't know what that is in today's dollars.
Yeah, that's a calculation. I think this, you know, if you make the calculation in modern dollars, I don't think it actually makes any sense. But he certainly was one of a handful of the richest. That's the point. But no, to your real question, no, I don't think you could become that rich and powerful by being a nice guy.
What got you interested in writing about him? There have already been many books about him. Have they all gotten it wrong?
Well, the books that have dealt with him have almost entirely been primarily about other people or other issues. And Vanderbilt is someone who, as I make the case in my book, that he was enormously important not only in making the modern economy, but also in the making of our values and our culture. Arguments about him, the role he played in the development of American economic culture and values is enormously important. And yet historians really have not dug into him, into his life. And the reason is that he didn't leave behind a collection of papers. And so I ended up spending years more than I planned to because I had to do all of this digging to find stuff about him. And I found a lot, but it took years and years and was scattered around different archives.
It was claimed that he was illiterate. Is that one of the reasons that he didn't leave behind any papers?
Well, you could say he was illiterate. He could spell a three-letter word three different ways in the same letter. So he was not a man of letters, let's say, but he certainly could read perfectly well, and he could write when he wanted to, even though he would spell phonetically. But his longtime clerk said after he died that he abominated papers and would pitch them into the fire. And the other thing is that so much of 19th century business was conducted in secret. And some of the letters that I looked at from various businessmen, which fortunately survived, had things like "burn this" and "destroy immediately" written at the top. And lucky for me, some of those survived.
That was before the Bush administration.
Yes, it's the same ethos. Of that.
Well, he was the son of a Staten Island farmer.
That is
so
correct.
This is an amazing story. This is beyond rags to riches.
Yes, absolutely. This is rising from peasant to king, essentially, which is the word that they used for him at the end of his life. You know, he was... his admirers saw him as he is the classic example of a meritocracy, the man who can rise by his own merits. But at the same time, he accumulated so much power and wealth, and he used it in such a purely self-interested way that he attracted a lot of critics like Mark Twain, for example, who just eviscerated him in a public letter to Vanderbilt published in 1869.
How much of what we know about him has come as the result of newspaper accounts of the battles over his will after he died?
That was probably, to use a much overused term, was the trial of the century, until probably the next trial of the century. It was two years and two months, I think, was how long it lasted, when he left 95% of this enormous estate to his oldest son, who was also his operational manager at the end of his life.
So even though he believed in a meritocracy, he wanted to create a dynasty.
Yeah, his life was full of contradictions. And he didn't leave much money to his daughters, relatively speaking. There were vast amounts, but it was the total that he left to all of his family except for that one son was only 5% of his estate. And so one of his daughters sued. And in order to undermine the will, there was a lot of salacious testimony. But even more than that, there was testimony that wasn't made, but the lawyer for her side said, well, you know, I'm going to bring in people who will say this. And the judge says that that's irrelevant. And those people didn't even testify. Then along come later writers who say, oh, people said that Vanderbilt did this, when in fact, nobody actually said that. But Vanderbilt, since no one has written about him specifically for so long, he's always been the guy in someone else's story who adds color. Someone who's writing about Victoria Woodhull or Jay Gould, they trot out Cornelius Vanderbilt and they use this will trial testimony to add color to their story.
And you seem to be claiming that his earlier biographers failed to look at his life in sufficient historical context. So is that why this book is so big, 720 pages with 112 pages of footnotes, because you had to provide all that context?
Yes, I think so. And as a writer as well as a biographer and historian, the challenge for me was to, you know, think what actually does the reader need to know? And then how do I write it so that it propels you forward and doesn't bog you down? And I think that so many of his business practices and his family life, his relationship to New York society, all of these elements of his life I tried to weave together, but I had to put it in the proper context.
My guest is T.J. Stiles, whose latest book is a biography of Cornelius Vanderbilt called The First Tycoon. In fact, it's the epic life of Cornelius Vanderbilt, and the book is epic size, published by Knopp. He made his early fortune running a steamboat line, later became an international steamship tycoon. So this is a guy who just understood how to take advantage of every job he had?
I think so. He was involved in a lot of different enterprises. As I dug into his life, I found so many more enterprises than we've known about before. But transportation was always the key. And in the 19th century, transportation overshadowed every other sector of the economy in a way that nothing, not even digital and computer technology does today. It was vastly larger than anything else. And he not only understood the mechanics of the business, but he also had an unerring sense for the sort of vital center, the main channel of commerce. And he would take control first with steamboats and then steamships and then finally railroads with the most lucrative, the busiest route. And he always selected routes that had permanent advantages over competitors.
And he was very competitive. He would undercut the prices charged by his competitors. And then when they were forced out of business, then he'd raise his prices.
Yeah, so though usually not to the...
He didn't begin that practice.
No, Actually, he started off, he had one employer in his life, a man who was his mentor, Thomas Gibbons. And that's a long story I won't go into, but Gibbons launched a fierce business competition. And it was a new thing on the American scene.
Well, how much of this was just being in the right place at the right time? For example, the gold rush occurs and he has steamboats.
Yes, except his steamboats were not equipped to go down to Central America and connect to the land crossing and then go up the Pacific to San Francisco. He had to launch into a new business to do that. So he was in the right place at the right time. As I point out in the book, he grew up in a rural family, but he lived right next to New York, which was the place where you had to be if you were going to make a great fortune. So it was a mixture of his innate abilities and simple good luck, yes.
Didn't he even look into building a canal across across Nicaragua years before the Panama Canal was constructed. I've always wondered why that canal plan was scrapped and replaced by the one in Panama, because if you look at the map, it looks a lot more feasible.
It's farther north, and also there's already a river that runs down from Lake Nicaragua, which is a huge freshwater lake in
Nicaragua.
You
didn't have to dig anything there. You had this lake that took you halfway across Nicaragua.
That's right, and a long river, and that was the plan originally. And Vanderbilt's plan, I dug into the archives of Baring Brothers, the investment bank in Britain, and he was trying to drum up British capital in order to build it. And he thought he had a very good plan for the canal that was economically feasible. But the Baring Brothers did their own analysis and decided it wouldn't make money. So they killed off the canal plan. As to its fate later on, because it was talked about decades later, I can't speak to that, unfortunately. But I think the Nicaraguan government to this day is talking about building a canal.
You've said that Vanderbilt understood the connection between business and politics. And during the Civil War, he outfitted his largest steamship to fight the Confederate Navy, donated it to the Union Navy. We're talking about a rather generous gift, weren't we?
Actually, it was a very generous gift. Vanderbilt was not someone whose primary legacy is charity, certainly not. Not like Andrew Carnegie, for example. But he was more generous than people realize. And he also was deeply patriotic. It's one of the counterpoints to his self-interested nature and his combative nature that's very interesting. He donated a nearly $1 million steamship to the Union Navy. He worked with the Union Navy with no compensation. And after the Civil War, he took on as a personal project trying to unite the divided North and South.
Is that why he created Vanderbilt University in Tennessee?
Absolutely. The specific connection came through his wife. She had a link to a bishop in Tennessee, and they were looking to start a university. But he very much wanted – his wife was from the South. He was proud that she – second wife, I should say. He was proud that she was from the South. He had General Braxton Bragg at his second wedding, the Confederate general. And he actually stood as a bondsman to get Jefferson Davis out of prison after the Civil War. It was a curious project that speaks to his patriotism.
He also connected Staten Island to Manhattan because he started the Staten Island Ferry. But how did he get into the railroad business and in the process, as you claim in this book, really create what we now think of as big business, the whole corporate culture?
That's right. His statue is still out in front of Grand Central.
Did he build Grand Central?
Staring down toward Wall Street, fittingly. He built the original Grand Central. The first railroad he took over in the Civil War, I actually point out he got into railroads very early, but he sort of got diverted during the gold rush to back into steamships and ocean-going steamships. As early as the 1840s, he was a president of a railroad company. But during the Civil War, he sold off his steamships. And he was 70 years old, and this is well past life expectancy. And he took over the New York and Harlem Railroad as a hobby. He was enormously proud. It's one of the things that drove him. And he said, I can take this company, which everyone thought was worthless, I can make it profitable. And due to the mechanics of the railroad industry, the way that different companies clashed, he ended up taking one railroad after another and building, almost without planning in advance, this enormous railroad empire. And out of business logic, he consolidated these railroads and created what I think is the forerunner of the modern corporation. So even though his specific business did not survive, you know, the state took over the railroads, but his legacy is very much in that modern giant corporation that dominates the world economy today.
So can he be blamed for initiating the depersonalization and institutionalization that's come to characterize so much of American business?
You can't blame any one individual for those things, but certainly he was a pioneer in that entire process.
You've noted that your book was written before the current financial crisis and that you haven't revised it to include any reflections on the current state of the economy, but have you thought about how Cornelius Vanderbilt would have dealt with today's global economy?
One of the themes that I develop in the book, I had no idea that it would be so relevant now, as I was writing the book, and that's the abstraction of the financial world during his lifetime. And this was a major cultural clash in the 19th century, something that seems strange to us now until perhaps this moment with mortgage-backed securities and credit default swaps. There is a whole sort of ether, financial ether, which seems to be removed from the real economy underneath. And this is something that Vanderbilt was dealing with. And he understood very well ahead of many of his contemporaries. So we see the origins of the kind of financial markets and securities and this abstract financial world in his life. It very much emerges out of his career.
You have taught in a number of major universities. You're not doing that anymore?
I taught at a master class in nonfiction creative writing at Columbia University. But teaching has been has never been a main line for me. I've been working and writing full-time for the most part.
And being an advisor on the PBS series, The American Experience, also writing for the New York Times Book Review, Salon.com, Smithsonian, Los Angeles Times. This book, the follow-up to the Jesse James book, is called The First Tycoon, The Epic Life of Cornelius Vanderbilt. It is published by Knopf, and it has gotten great reviews. People have marveled that you have kept them interested throughout all the 720 pages.
That's right. I should point out that it's not 720 pages of full text, because I do provide a lot of annotation, and there's
And there's an index in the back.
And there's an index, yeah. I hate it when I'm bored by a book. And I had a lot of information to present, and I had a big story to tell.
T.J. Stiles will be speaking with Kevin Baker tonight at 7 o'clock at the 42nd Street Public Library South Court Auditorium. For more information, go to our show page at WNYC.org. The book, The First Tycoon, is published by Knopf. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you.